Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Bina 2021. Great to see everyone. Welcome all those that are on Zoom, and it's wonderful to see all those that are here. Just once again, we're going to be doing it this term, both here and on Zoom. So anyone, just make sure the office knows that you're coming, and all good. So the topic for the series is, it's called Eat the Fruit and Throw Away the Peel, which I'm going to explain in a minute, Lessons from 2020. So today we're going to just explain the topic and do a small sort of lesson and then develop it much more in greater detail over the coming weeks. So we know that it's obvious, it's cliched already, that 2020 was an interesting year. Not just the virus, actually. Just look from the very beginning in Australia, right? So we started off with the fires, which were pretty devastating. Coronavirus, which crippled the world, and then upheaval in the world, political upheaval, which I'm not going to get into the political side of things, but it's not my brief at all. But it did cause a lot of chaos, a lot of confusion. And as I said, I'm not getting involved in political discussion, but there are lessons to be learned, and I think there's some things we could take away and think about, right? By the way, apologies that I'm sitting. It's a bit different than normal just because I need to do it for the Zoom, so just different format a little bit. One day we'll be properly back to normal, but we're getting there. So I wanted to sort of start off where I left off in the very last session that we did. I'm not sure who was there, but and that sort of feeds into what the topic is today, right? So the topic is, as I said, eat the fruit and throw away the peel. And what that means is, it's based on a story. That expression is based on a story from the Talmud. That the Talmud, and we've mentioned this before, the Talmud talks about a great sage called Rabbi Meir. And Rabbi Meir had a teacher, a very, very, one of the greatest sages of the Talmud at the time. His name was Rabbi Elisha ben Avuya. It was a tremendous halachic and genius of a sage, and he taught Torah and so on and so forth. And then, this is probably the only time that this happened, he was a Talmudic sage, this Rabbi Yeshua, this Elisha ben Avuya, who became a heretic. He left the whole thing and he became a heretic, but yet remained tremendously interested in Torah teaching. So he continued to teach, but most of the sages left him. They want to learn from someone who was worthy of teaching, someone who lived what they taught, practiced what they preached, so to speak. And so they left him, but Rabbi Meir continued. Rabbi Meir, who remained a very devout sage, Rabbi Meir, also one of the greatest Talmudic sages, continued to learn from him. He continued to learn Torah from him. So the sages asked him, how can you do that? Like, he's such a negative guy. I mean, he became a heretic. He's left the ways of Torah mitzvot. He's abandoned his belief. Okay, so he's a smart guy, but when you learn Torah from someone, Torah is not just an academic subject. It's something which has holiness, something that has value to it. You should really learn from someone that's worthy. Why do you continue to learn from him? To which Rabbi Meir responded, and he said, he used a phrase which I think can be used for a lot of things, and he said, it's like you eat a pomegranate. That was the analogy he gave, and he said, Tocha achal klipato zarak. You eat the inside, you eat the fruit, and you throw away the peel. He says, I know how to do that. I can learn from him, and I won't take the bad stuff. The bad stuff I will throw away. The good stuff I'll take. And so it happened, and they remained close until the end of Rabbi Elisha ben Avuya's life. His name changed to Acher. He was called Acher from then. And they remained very, very close. To the point, it's actually a bizarre story. They were so, and they sort of respected each other, that one time it was Shabbat, and Rabbi Meir was learning a very, this was, by the way, I'm just telling you because I'm telling the story, so I'll include this. It was Shabbat, Rabbi Meir was listening to his teacher explain a very, very deep thing, and his teacher was on a donkey, which you're not supposed to ride on Shabbat. And of course, Rabbi Meir wasn't. Rabbi Meir was walking next to him, and they were walking together, and there's halacha, there's a law, when you travel outside a city, you can only go a certain distance, and once that distance comes to an end, it's called tchum. The 2,000 cubits come to an end, you can't go anymore. So they arrived at this spot, and Rabbi Meir's teacher, Acher, was a very smart person. He knew exactly where he was. And he turned to Rabbi Meir and he said, lesson over. I'm continuing on, but you got to go back now. So they were, right? So they were like sort of respect each other that way. And there is one version of the Talmud that at the very, very end of his life, on his deathbed, they talked to each other and he actually repented. But anyway, that's a separate story. But the core of the lesson is this concept of tocho achal v'klipato zarak. You eat the fruit and you throw away the peel. That's a very, very important life lesson. That often we experience certain things that are have a lot of negativity to them. And we kind of want to just turn our back on the whole thing. You know? People want to say, I don't want to even think about last year. I don't want to think about all the things. It's gone and finished, right? So on one hand, that's true. And we should move on. We shouldn't get stuck in the past. We'll soon see. But we shouldn't just turn our back, because it is really important that when something happens, we use it. And when something happens, we learn from it. Because there's nothing that happens in the world. This is the principle, right? If we believe what the Torah tells us, there's nothing that happens in the world that doesn't have components that can be used for the good going forward. It might have negative things which you don't understand or we can't relate to. So that's the peel we throw away. Those are the bad things that hide the fruit. And that's true. So we throw that away. But we shouldn't throw away the whole thing. We shouldn't throw away the whole fruit, because there's a beautiful fruit which is in the peel. The peel is not edible, but the fruit is. And therefore we need to learn the art of eating the fruit and throwing away the peel, which is what we're going to do in this series. Obviously, the throwing away the peel is easy. We want to throw lots of the upheaval of 2020 away. Although, I mean, I think it's important to mention, this is parenthetically, when we talk about 2020, we also need, I think sitting here in Australia, need to be very, very grateful. And I mean, that's an obvious thing, but I think it's an important thing just to acknowledge, right? And at the same time, be sensitive to the rest of the world. It hit this past Shabbat in the afternoon. So we had mincha. I actually wasn't here. I was home, but my son was here. My son-in-law and between mincha and maariv, basudash l'shit, someone always says a few words. So this week, it was the first week back for Rabbi Smakler. So my son asked him to say a few words, and he repeats me what he said, and it sort of hit me. He was just in Israel. He went for his son's wedding, and he described what Israel looks like. Right. And honestly, we live on a different planet here. It's like unbelievable. Seriously, a different planet. I mean, he was talking about how you walk the streets and you see businesses that have signs that they're shut down permanently, not shut down because of the lockdown. People lost their jobs, they lost their businesses. Many, not just a few. I mean, it happened here too, but not at that level, right? He says you go to the kotel and it's empty. I mean, can you imagine going to the kotel and it's empty? It's like a depressing thought even to think about it, right? So, and people are doing it really tough. I mean, we know just this last week, there were some very famous deaths and so on. So it's important. I think that's part of being a good human being, is being sensitive, not just to live in our cocoon, but actually being sensitive to what's happening in the rest of the world. But we all had our challenges, and this year wasn't easy for anyone, even Australia, but it's also important every day just take a few moments to express gratitude for the wonderful blessing that we had of living here. That's the truth, right? And it's another way to say it. So, okay. So I want to just share a couple of things before we start. Before we get into the actual topic. So one of the things is, you know, I was hesitating to use this topic. And I'll tell you why. Because a couple of people told me, you know, it's not such a good topic about lessons you can take away from 2020, from the year 2020, because everyone's over it already, right? No one wants to hear about the virus anymore. No one wants to hear about coronavirus, which is true. And I don't plan to talk a lot about the virus, but I want to talk about people more than the virus. But nevertheless, I wanted to press on, and I'll tell you why. And I want to share with you something which is anyway good to share. Because we cannot just say, yeah, I've learned that and put it on a shelf and now I can move on, right? So this week, I just want to show you something very beautiful that I saw. This week, unfortunately, the world lost so many great people, but also lost a very great person, Rabbi Twersky, Rabbi Dr. Twersky. Those of you who have been part of the Thursday morning for a long time know that I'm a big fan of Rabbi Twersky, and I've used him a lot, particularly in the very beginning of our Thursday morning lectures. I wrote a post this week, some of you might have seen in my Facebook post, where I actually just sort of express gratitude that actually he inspired me on the personal growth journey, and a lot of the beginning of the Thursday morning and all the whole Bina Living sort of stream that we do really comes a lot from him. He was an amazing, amazing person, an incredibly intelligent, brilliant human being, and very, very humble. I mean, he was an ordained rabbi and practicing as a rabbi already at 21. He comes from a long line of Hasidic rabbis, very knowledgeable people. Grew up in America, Milwaukee, and then decided that being a rabbi wasn't going to do it for him. He wasn't going to be able to accomplish as much as he wanted to accomplish. remained a very devout Hasidic Jew throughout his entire life, but went off and left the rabbinate, became a psychiatrist, and became a world expert on a lot of personal growth areas, and particularly addictions. He set up centers of rehabilitation, an amazing, amazing human being. Now, around 30 years ago, I think it was, or maybe under 30 years ago, his wife passed away, and he remarried. So someone writes this. He says, 8 years ago, 16 years into his second marriage, he said to one of his nephews, he said, "When I wake up every day, I think to myself, what can I do today to enhance my shalom bayit? What can I do today to enhance my marriage?" So the nephew was completely shocked. And he said to his uncle, who had a beautiful marriage, his second marriage was beautiful, as was his first. He said, "Come on, after all these years, it doesn't come naturally?" Right? So Rabbi Twersky answered, he said, "No, a person is a person. People do not change unless they consciously work on themselves." It's a very simple line, but like with everything with Rabbi Twersky, the lines are simple and the messages are profound, right? And that's so true. So we cannot just experience something, think we've learned the lesson, or ignore the lesson, either way, and then move on, right? If there's lessons to be learned, and there are many lessons to be learned, and we need to learn those lessons because otherwise it's a waste of a year. Right? To move on from a year like 2020, which globally and in Australia, right, was a very, very different year, and not to learn the lessons is just, I don't know how to say it, it's just really a pity. Because it's a pity, and it goes against the very grain of personal growth, and it goes against a principle that the Rambam so eloquently says. And he says to us, he says that when someone experiences something, when something happens in the world, right? The way the Rambam puts it, Maimonides, he says it's an insensitive thing to say it's just a coincidence, just happened. Use his language, mikra nikra, it's just something that happened, right? But as believing people, we believe nothing just happens. And therefore everything that happens has lessons, and those lessons need to be learned, and those lessons need to be revisited and reviewed and reflected upon and internalized again and again and again, like Rabbi Twersky says, because people don't change unless they constantly work on themselves. And therefore we have to keep on learning them and keep on thinking about them. As we've said many, many times, that we have this concept Kabbalistically, where our brain works in three levels, right? Kabbalistically, we know that we have three components of intellect: Chachma, Bina, and Daat. Chachma is the conception of an idea, Bina is the understanding, and Daat is the connection to it. And the reason why so many people learn amazing things and don't change, or don't improve themselves and don't take the next step forward, is because, not because they don't have Chachma and Bina, they're very intelligent people. So their Chachma is fine and their Bina is fine. They've understood it very, very deeply, and if they have a good memory, they can remember it. I know people that can repeat to me things. I'm not one of those lucky ones, but I know people that can repeat to me complete topics that they learned when they were in yeshiva when they were 17 or 18, right? Because they've left with a very good memory. That's fine. But one thing is for sure, and this applies to all people, good memory or not, it won't change you unless you have the third component, which is Da'at. Da'at is you've got to connect to it. You've got to internalize it. You've got to really become one with it. That's what Kabbalah teaches us. And that is that connecting point between the head and the heart, between what is in our brain and what affects us emotionally. And to have that, you have to always keep on talking about it. You have to meditate on it, reflect on it, think about it, internalize it. So therefore, although some of these things are kind of we're over, but we need to come back to them and we need to talk about them. But at the same time, just to go back to the topic of eat the fruit and throw away the peel, we also do need to throw away the peel. That's really important. Because you see, there are two dangerous ways of approaching something that happened. Either you throw away the whole thing, the fruit as well, which is a great pity, because there's so much to learn from and so much to take away. Or what some people is, they hang on to the fruit and the peel. And that's a problem. That's true with everything in life. Right, we experience negativity, we experience challenging times, we experience confusing times, and there's a lot of fruit in there, and there's stuff to learn, there's stuff we need to take away, but we don't only take the fruit. We take the fruit and the peel, and when we take the fruit and the peel, we get stuck in the peel. And that's what we hang on to. And we keep on complaining about how bad the peel tastes when we could have thrown away the peel a long time ago. So I wanted to share with you also something I saw this week, a beautiful idea from the previous Belzer Rebbe. I'll just give you a bit of background. I might have shared this with some of you, but an amazing thing actually happened to me this time last year. So before the war, there was an amazing, amazing tzaddik, an amazing person. His name was the Belzer Rebbe. He was the head of a great Hasidic dynasty called Belz. They're very big in Israel as well now, in Yerushalayim. And this person was a very serious tzaddik. He was known to be a very spiritual person. He was performed lots of miracles. He was an amazingly holy person. He, in the war, lost his entire family, his wife, his children, everyone. Only one that remained was himself. He survived and a brother of his. And eventually, somewhere in the middle of the war, they actually managed to escape and they arrived in Israel. And he settled in Tel Aviv. Now, I say this just with a bit of detail because my father, of blessed memory, always used to talk about this because my father grew up in Tel Aviv. And he remembers when the Belzer Rebbe came. And he was from a Chabad family, but he remembers in Tel Aviv how he set up a shul there, and he set up a little thing, and people used to go to him. And he says, he used to describe, when I was a child, I used to hear this a lot. He used to describe to me, like, what kind of, he hardly ate this person, he used to daven, and he was an amazingly holy person. And he rebuilt this group in Israel, right? Just why I'm mentioning it is because last year, I was in Israel this time, actually, when was it, beginning of January? It's the last time I think I traveled. I was in Tel Aviv. I don't normally spend time in Tel Aviv in Israel. I normally spend more time in Yerushalayim, but I was in Tel Aviv for a wedding, so I was there. So I decided, I heard that the Belzer shul is still there. It's an amazing thing. Like the shul that this rabbi set up is still there. Even though the group has moved to Yerushalayim, the current Belzer Rebbe lives in Yerushalayim. So I went there, and I Googled it, and I tracked it down. I took a walk there, plenty of time. And arrived there, yes, and it was an amazing thing that the exact same building is still there. As he came, his shul is still there, his room is still there. So I went there, and I davened, there was a morning minyan. And afterwards, I figured, I've got to find an old person here who might remember, maybe by some fluke, remember my family, right? Anyway, so someone with a very long white beard. I said, hey, where are you from? Sydney. Ah, Sydney. She was like, Sydney, to those kind of people, it's like the end of the world. I said, yeah, actually, I really have a connection to this place, and I'm just interested about it. I started telling him that my father grew up here and he used to come here. My father used to tell me about this place and it's beautiful to see it. It was an amazing piece of history. He says, what's your name? He says, Garari. He says, Garari, your grandfather lived on Fireberg Street? I said, yeah. it was amazing. So he got together a few other people. They remembered my great uncle and grandfather. It was a very, very beautiful piece of history. Why am I telling you this? Not just to tell you personal history. Because this Rebbe arrived in Israel in 1944. He arrived in Israel. And he actually arrived in Haifa, I think it was, first, before he settled in Tel Aviv. And the first Shabbat, he ran what's called in the Hasidic world a tish. A tish, like they have a sit around table, they sing songs. And he was determined to rebuild as many people, in an amazing way. He sits around the table, and he sees who's there, just a few survivors, who also came from a Hasidic background. And when you sit down by a tish, you got to sing a few songs, you share a vart, you sing more songs, and the Hasid, if you ever went to Hasid, it's an amazing experience, actually. I mean, the ones that have thousands of people are really amazing. Like, they get into it, the energy is fantastic. But of course, the Belzer Rebbe on the first Shabbos, which happened to be, by the way, the Shabbos that we just passed, B'Shalach, the parasha was B'Shalach. He sits down and he sees, as they say in Yiddish, a segeit nisht. It's not working. These guys are battered. They're struggling. What's that? Okay. Yeah, not happening. He sees that they broken, legitimately so. There's people who lost their families, as he did. And understandably so, still very living in the suffering that they just emerged from, right? So he stops and he talks to him and he says, listen, I know what you're feeling, but let me share with you something. He said, this Shabbat, this is past Shabbat, it's called Shabbat Shira. We tell the story of when the Jews came out of Egypt. When they came out of Egypt, they came to the Red Sea and had this amazing thing where they were stuck. The Egyptian army was pursuing them and they realized there's nowhere to go. There's an army behind them. There's a sea in front of them. And they panic, right? They panic. God says, don't panic. Keep moving, right? But there's an ocean there, right? So we know the famous miracle. Kriyat Yamsuf. The sea splits. The sea splits and they're able to pass by. Then the Egyptians come into the same sea, and then the sea closes in on them, and they don't survive, and the Jews are safe. They come out of the sea, and they see and they see that they've been rescued. So they sing a song of praise, a famous piece of the Torah called the Shira, a song. Az Yashir Moshe, Moshe Rabbeinu sang, and the Bnei Israel, and they thanked God for all the amazing miracles. They highlighted how the Exodus took place with such miraculous nature, how the nations saw the name, the hand of God, and so on and so forth. Okay. However, if you look at the beginning of that Shira, you'll see a very strange grammatical concept, and that is that it says there, instead of saying, and then Moses and the Jewish people sang, it says, as Yashir, which in Hebrew means, then Moses and the Jewish people will sing. That doesn't make sense. They sang. What do you mean, will sing? Right? So the Talmud says a very strange comment. Talmud says that this is one of the sources in the Torah for one of the 13 principles of faith. We know there's 13 principles of faith that we as Jews live by, which is in the song, also embedded in the song Yigdal, which many shuls sing on Friday night. And the last one, you remember, is Metim Yechayekel, that there will be a time, there will be the resurrection of the dead. So here we have a source in the Torah for this concept. It's not talked about explicitly in the Torah, but it's hinted in that parsha, because it says, here Moshe Rabbeinu and the Jewish people will sing. Not they sang, they will sing. Meaning there'll be a time in the future that Moses and the Jewish people will come back and they'll still sing. So they sang then, but they're going to sing again. All right? So the Belzer Rebbe asks, he says, if God wanted to embed into the Chumash in the Torah a hint for the resurrection of the dead in the future, why put it in this story? Why in the story of the Red Sea? I mean, God couldn't find a different place in the Chumash. Why specifically this story? So he gave a different take on the whole thing. He said like this. He said, let's understand what happened here. The Jews just came out of Egypt, right? Out of 210 years, the last 86 of which were terrible persecution. Slavery, they'd been battered, their children were thrown into the Nile River. Real, real, real oppression. Not only that, but what we don't always highlight, you know, on Pesach, we talk about the story of the Exodus. What we forget to highlight sometimes is that not the whole Jewish people came out of Egypt. I don't know if you know this, right? Yes, God redeemed the Jewish people, but only the people that wanted to. There were people that were very skeptical, didn't want to come out of Egypt, they didn't trust Moshe Rabbeinu, and they died in Egypt. They didn't come out. And according to one Midrash, there's a staggering number that actually 4/5 of the Jewish nation didn't come out. Right? So you've got a large nation standing at the Red Sea, battered from years of persecution and oppression, who many of them have just lost their family. Because 4/5 of the Jewish people, 80% of the Jewish people didn't make it out. So you think they're in the mood of singing? They're going to sing a song. You think they're in the mood of singing? How do they? It's a beautiful song they sang. Yashir Moshe, the Shira. If you see the words, it's poetic words that express jubilation, express joy, express confidence, express hope. He says to these people around the table, you think the Jewish people are in the mood of singing? Right? We don't always think of it in this context, but that's the way he put it. And he said, you know why they sang? Because Moshe Rabbeinu told them, it's not the end of the story. Az Yashir Moshe. There's still going to be a lot of singing in the future. Yes, you've come from a terrible time. Yes, we should remember that terrible time. We should learn from that time. Which is why till today by the Seder, one of the mitzvot of the Seder is not just to eat matzah. One of the mitzvot of the Seder is to eat bitter herbs. Strange thing. Why? Only after so many years, we still have to remember the bitter times in Egypt. Yes, because you can't really experience Exodus unless you remember and learn from where you came from. So here we've got to continuously, and much of the theme of the Seder is not just remembering the Exodus, but it's remembering the good times. Remembering the bad times, remember the slavery and the bitter times, which is why we have a mitzvah to eat maror on Pesach night. And if you don't eat maror, you haven't completed the Seder, right? Because that's an important part, but you don't get stuck in the maror. You look ahead. Why? Because even if it's still tough, and even if you just come from there, there's a big future ahead. Az Yashir Moshe. It's not the end of the story. There's still going to be a lot of singing in the future. That's what the Bel... I thought I'd share this with you. It's the most beautiful idea. And that's what the Belzerov shared with us. Few battered survivors around the table. And that's the message. And that's the hope he put into them. And what's the result? The result is, if you go today to Yerushalayim and you see the Belzer Center, if you ever went there, it's amazing. Right? What happened was, he had one brother who died quite young. He died a lot longer. That one brother who had lost his family, remarried, had one son, and then he died young, the brother. This son was about 20 years old at the time, and they trained him, so to speak. He took over the movement. When his uncle died, the tzaddik, he took over, and he built I've been there a few times, it's the most flourishing movement today. Schools, institutions, yeshivat, this huge center in Jerusalem. It's the most fascinating movement. Right? Why? Because when he came to Tel Aviv in 1944, he said the story isn't over. There's going to be a lot of singing, right? So that's an extreme case, but we take this light, we take this less like we always do, even for little things, right? Even for little things, you know, people were, we came from a year, again, we had a good year, relatively speaking, but still we had a year of confusion, a year of that lack of clarity, a year of upheaval. Many people were affected, mental health was affected, many people found it very stressful to be uncertain about things, and lack of clarity and lack of certainty, and so on and so forth. So we have to learn from all of that, take the lessons, but not get stuck in the peel. Focus on the future. Remember the year, but focus on now. What do we do? How do we keep growing? How do we keep improving? How do we becoming a better person? Okay. So that's the general principle. So for today, what I want to focus on, I'm going to share with you an idea that I read in an essay by Rabbi Y.Y. Jacobson, who I'm sure many of you have read his stuff or heard his stuff. He's very, very good. And sometimes he shares things which are really particularly beautiful. So it's a very beautiful insight, and I'm going to share it with you because it's around the probably the number one lesson that we have to learn from this past year, which will probably be the foundation of all the other lessons that we need to learn. Which, and I'm going to say what it is in a minute, but it's almost, I've said it so many times already because it's almost like a cliche, but we have to un-cliche it, because instead of saying it as a cliche, we have to live by it, right? And to say it is very easy. I mean, you say it many times, it becomes a cliche, but to live by it is actually hard. That's why I have to keep talking about it. And that's the concept of control, right? Of who's in control, and are we in control? And if there's one lesson that we learned this year is we're not in control, right? So let me share with you this incredible insight and to show you how hard it is, but nevertheless, how important it is to learn from it. It's his essay, but it's based on, he bases it on two commentaries. One's called the Ben Ish Chai, the other one is called the Netziv. Two great people, two great scholars, one Sephardi, one Ashkenazi, who lived in the late 1800s. So, you know, in the Chumash, there's a famous story, in the Torah, there's a famous story. The flood, right? Flood, Noah and the flood. So, corrupt society, God's not happy, almost regrets that he's created a human being, and he destroys the civilization at the time through a flood. Then, thankfully, he promises afterwards there won't be a flood, he makes a covenant, they will never do that again, and from then on, he trusts human beings, that we're going to sort it out ourselves, we're going to improve and grow and become better people, so you won't have to do that. Okay. So that's the story of the flood. That's a famous story. However, in the same portion of the Torah, there's a much less famous story that only takes up 9 verses, but a significant story because it affected humankind forever. And it's called the story of the Tower of Babel. Migdal Babel, right? The reason why it's not so famous is, first of all, it's overshadowed. When you read that portion of the Chumash, it's overshadowed by the story of the flood. It didn't happen that much long after the flood, but it was after the flood. And also, it's written very cryptically, and it's always not understood exactly what's going on there. But essentially, it was about a group of people who were living at the center of civilization at that time, which was sort of the Middle East. And they gather in a valley in the land of Shinar, which is sort of ancient Babylonia, modern-day Iraq, okay? And they gather in a large valley between the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers. And the Torah tells us that at that time, all the people spoke one language. They were a really united group, homogenous group. And they decided they're going to undertake the most daring building project to date. And they're going to build a tower that is going to reach heaven. It's going to reach Shammai, right? A tower above. They're going to reach this. They're going to build this tower that's going to reach all the way up to the sky. Not quite clear exactly what the problem was or what they wanted to do, what their aim was, but that's what it says, right? And it seems from the psukim, it seems from the verse, they're going to build this tower and they're going to have all humanity relocate to heaven, right? Maybe they thought it was better up there. I don't know exactly what the reason was. Okay. God is not happy. We'll see what the problem was in a minute, but he wasn't happy. And what he does is he creates chaos. How does God create chaos? He makes them forget the one language, and everyone has different languages all of a sudden. In fact, in our tradition, that's the source of diversity of language, right? So no one can communicate with each other, no one understands each other, no, right? And everyone goes their own way. After the infighting, they create their own civilization, their own group, and to use the language of the Torah, from there extends and expands civilization in its different ways and its unique ways. Okay. Now, what we need to understand is, what was their crime? What was the problem? Okay, I mean, it was a stupid idea, obviously, but what was the crime? What was the? It's seen as a very bad thing. What was their crime? Why was God so unhappy? So the Torah doesn't tell us. And also, the Torah doesn't tell us actually what happened to that tower. Because they actually got quite far until it got all messed up. They built this tower, this amazing tower, right? But the Talmud fills in the gaps, right? The oral Torah. The Talmud tells us like this, that there's one place in the Talmud where it says it briefly, and then there's a Midrash which sort of expands and elaborates. So the great sage Rabbi Yochanan said the following. He said, this tower... Listen to the words, and you'll see what we're going to do with this, right? He said, the third of the tower, the top part, was burnt, right? A third of the tower was buried. And a third remains intact. Right? I should mention to you, not that it makes a difference to me, but I should mention to you that there was an amazing archaeological discovery a number of years ago in that region, of stuff that looked like remnants of a very big tower, which is interesting. Okay. Now, the Midrash sort of elaborates and says the following. He says, the tower they built, a third that was burnt, a third sunk to the ground, and the third still remains in existence. And then the Midrash says, lest you think that the remainder is small, in other words, only a third, such a small little building. No, Rabbi Huna said in the name of Rabbi Eddie that if one goes to the top of the remaining part of the tower and looks down, the palm trees look like grasshoppers. That's how high it is. That's only a third, right? Now, all this is very cryptic, and what relevance does it have, and what does it mean to us? What's the story? So, what he shares with us, based on these two commentators, is a beautiful idea. That the three parts of the tower represent the three crimes that the Jewish people committed, I mean, not Jewish people, the people of the time, committed by building this tower, okay? Because we do find in the Midrash, and we're going to connect these two things together, that there were three possible transgressions, three possible things that were so wrong about building this tower. Okay. The first one is that they wanted to build a tower to fight against God, right? In their old-fashioned pagan sort of understanding of it, God was like this idol or this big bully or something. And they saw him as a threat to civilization, to free civilization. So they figured, in order for us to move on, we've got to build this tower, go up to heaven and fight him. That's it. Yeah. Another explanation was that their crime was they wanted to create, I guess like a communist society, a totalitarian, homogenous society, where there'd be this control where we'd force everyone to live together, to share the same language, to share the same culture. And that was considered a crime, as we'll soon see, because God didn't want that. That's not the design of the creation, right? In other words, they took the fact that they spoke one language at the time as a cue for them to build this tower, which would be a symbol of power, which would control a complete homogeneous society where the language wouldn't just be a language of convenience that everyone speaks, but it would be part of the culture and the control of wealth and the control of distribution and the control of everything would all be one thing. There'll be one society, right? But that was a crime. That's the one thing, right? And then the third explanation is, the third opinion is that the reason they built the tower is they wanted to build a defense against a future flood. Right? Flood. The world wasn't that long after the flood, that flood that had destroyed most of the civilized world, right? So they had this idea that the reason there was a flood was because every once in a while the heavens become weak. And when they become weak, they, you know, the faucet opens up and there's a flood. So they decided they're going to, in some sort of brilliant building idea, they're going to fortify the sky. So they're going to build this amazing tower, which is going to be a... What they call the building, one of these like beams, you know? But they go horizontal. This one was going vertical, right? It was going to be one of these beams that are going to hold up the sky. Yeah? You know, we do that in buildings today, right? I just know we just did a ration. I thought the roof's going to fall in, but we have these beams, so it's okay, it's good. It's all strong now, right? So They thought there'd be tremendous flooding. So what they did was the thing was intended to hold up the sky. Okay. So what's the problem? Problem is obviously what was the error? The error was, of course, that the flood doesn't come from a weak sky. The flood was a divinely inspired punishment or occurrence or experience that they had no control over, but they thought they did. Okay. That's the case. Let's now understand the three consequences. So what happens, they're all wrong. All these three reasons are crimes, right? To fight against God is a crime. To create oneness of society is a crime. To think you control future occurrence in the world is also a crime. So what happens to all these crimes? So we learn that the tower divided into three. And three correlate, this is the beauty of this idea, the three correspond to these three transgressions. So the first motivation is to fight God. Fighting God is a very old-fashioned, archaic perception of paganism, right? That's what it was. The ancient civilizations thought that's the way the world runs. There's this multiple array of gods. Each god is like another deity, another being of some sort, in charge of something else. Some of them are good, some of them are evil. And they pray to them, they offer sacrifices to them, right? That was ancient pagan worship. That part of the tower is burnt, disappeared. We don't have that today anymore. We have traces of it, but we don't have that today, right? In fact, he doesn't bring this, but the Talmud is actually, we look at it as bizarre today. We look at it as so archaic and stupid, right? I mean, we have other idols that we serve today, which are more symbolic, but the straight and literal sort of form of pagan worship, we look at today as absolutely silly and old-fashioned, right? And it wasn't always that way. In fact, according to the Talmud, because we read even in Tanakh, we read in the first temple, right? Jews who were very knowledgeable Jews, and then there was the temple times, the times of the kings, there was a huge problem. Sometimes it was rampant, this issue of pagan worship. Right? They used to build these images and pursue them, right? I mean, Abraham had fought against that, but and had reintroduced monotheism, but later on it would still remain. And in fact, there came a time where the Talmud says that the Sanhedrin, this is between the, like, roughly around the 500 before the Common Era, we call the Anshei Knesset HaGadolah, a great group of legislators, some of them prophets and great people, got together and they convened and they prayed to God to remove this urge for pagan worship, because like people were stumbling on it, even and didn't even make rational sense. It was completely stupid. And God responded and he said, okay, I will, right? In fact, Talmud tells a fascinating dream about one of the great Talmudic sages who had a problem in his learning. He was trying to figure out a deep, complex piece in halachic analysis, and had a dream that one of the kings of Israel, Menashe, King Menashe, who was a very famous king, a very evil king, right, appeared to him, and he sorted out the whole thing for him. He explained it to him, how you understand the whole piece of, and he said to him, you're a Torah scholar? He says, of course I'm a Torah scholar, much bigger than you. So he looked at him in his dream, and he says, if you're a Torah scholar, how come you serve idols? Why did you involve in pagan worship? So he said, you don't understand what the temptation was. And I guarantee you, he said to him in his dream, I guarantee you, if you would have lived in my times, you would run. You'd pick up your coat, you would run to serve idols, right? We don't understand it. Today it's silly. So it's a pagan worship temptation, which was around in ancient times. Says the Talmud, that was the sin of the people who built the tower. But that part of the tower is burnt. It's gone, thank God. It's no longer here. The second part of the tower is buried. Why? It comes back every so often, right? It comes back in the form of socialism, total socialism, communism, right? All these different societies who think it's a good idea to create societies where everyone is completely equal, right? I don't know this. He quotes here in his essay a nice, where is it? A nice saying which I didn't know. Here we are. Apparently Churchill said that capitalism is the unequal distribution of wealth, communism is the equal distribution of misery. Right? So it's being tried, it always looks good, people follow it, Marxism, communism, all this stuff, total socialism, and always fails, and it doesn't work, but it gets tried until people realize that's not working, right? I mean, there are aspects of it that could even be good, etc., but in total it doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? It doesn't work because actually the essence of society, the way God designed the human experience, is that it shouldn't be that way. For whatever reason, right? On many, many, many levels. First of all, the level that, like the Talmud says, a saying which we've mentioned 1,000 times, and that is, that just like no two people look alike, no two people think alike, right? Diversity, individualism is a very, very important thing because everyone has a unique contribution to make to the universe, right? We all have a different mission. We might have common values. We might have, you know, as Jews, we might have a common Torah that teaches us some common principles which we have to adhere to, but yes, we express them in different ways. The Jewish people were built on the fact that there was patriarchs and matriarchs, three patriarchs and four matriarchs, but then it broke down into 12 different tribes. We are called the Bnei Yisrael because we are children of Yaakov, who had, was called Israel, who had 12 different sons, who became 12 different tribes, who lived in 12 different areas in Israel, who did different things, and had different missions. Yisachar, the tribe of Yisachar, for example, were scholars. Zvulun were business people. Different, each great and valuable, but they were different, because that's the way God wants people to exist. He created a world with incredible multiplicity. Now, I don't know these statistics, but it's quoted in this essay. I'm going to read it to you. Do you know that? There are 390,000 different types of plants, 10,000 species of birds, 60,000 species of trees, 5.5 million species of insects. Did you know that? And 7,000 species of mammals, 34,000 species of fish. That's crazy, right? Now we have to like 6,500 languages, something like that, right? But it's supposed to be like that. In other words, the reason is not just a pun. When we say that God in the Tower of Babel mixed up the languages and created chaos, on the surface when you read it, its simple reading is that he created chaos to punish them. But on the deeper level, he wasn't creating chaos to punish them. He was creating chaos because he was saying you abused the one language that you all speak. It was convenient for everyone to speak one language, but it's wrong. You're abusing it. There's going to be different languages from now on. To emphasize that there's different types of people, there's different nations, there's different cultures, and they all have a very unique and specific and very important place to play, role to play, right? Are there risks in difference? Of course there are risks in difference. Is diversity abused? Is extreme capitalism is a form of sometimes abusing difference? All good, all true. But you don't fight that by creating one homogenous group, because that's not the way the world works. Because we have to be different. And we have to do different things. We have to think differently. We have to bring different perspectives. Even distribution of wealth. The Talmud already talks about that. Right, the Talmud says that, it's a famous question. One heretic asked one of the sages of the Talmud, if God has everything, then why can't he give everyone what they need? Why are there the have and the have-nots? Right? So he said, because, this is what the answer to the Talmud was, because God wanted a world of kindness. And to have a world of kindness, you have to have givers and takers. You have to have people that give and you have to have people that receive. And by extension, that's not just about financial wealth, it's about everything. We all have things that other people don't have. Right? That's why I've spoken about this before, that it's important not only to know how to give. Giving is a very, very important skill to learn to develop, to be able to give. Chesed, the concept of chesed, tzedakah, helping people, supporting other people. But also actually it's important to learn how to receive. Take has negative connotation about how to receive. Because we always have to be on the receiving end sometimes. We might be experiencing something traumatic. We have to receive from other people. We might need an idea that someone else knows more about. We have to learn to learn. Some people know, they don't want to learn. They don't want to talk to other people because they can do it all alone. They land up in a big mess. Why? Because the world was designed for everyone to be different, and therefore everyone and every culture and every experience and every type of people to have what to give that others don't have what to give. Right? That's why this sin, this transgression of the Tower of Babel to create this one control system was a crime. What happened to that part of the tower? It got buried. Because it comes up every... It's still there, but it's not there all the time. It's still there. But what's the most difficult part of the tower? What was the third transgression? That they wanted to hold up the world, that there shouldn't be another flood. That's not buried and it's not burnt. It's still here. And it's been the human disease ever since we were created. That we think we can control the world. Right? That part of the tower is still there. And the Talmud says it's still very high. Right? And it's very high in our times more than before. With technology and the environment, the sophistication and the discoveries that God has allowed us to discover. And given opportunity to the human race to be able to advance. Whether it's medical research, whether it's other technology, whatever the case is, right? We have developed things in the reproductive technology, in longevity, things that are amazing breakthroughs, things that have never ever existed in the humankind. And what's the result? That we think we control everything. We think we have an answer for everything. And that tower is still there, right? And then God sends a little thing that is, how big is it? It's 125 nanometers. I'm not sure what that is, but apparently it's very, very microscopic. Right? Because we lose sight and we take things for granted. And we start believing in our own control way too much. So again, I'm not someone who explains why things happen, and I don't know that. I don't know why God does things, and I shouldn't know. But I do know, we all know, that we can learn certain lessons. And if there's that one lesson that we learn from 2020, is that that tower, which is still there, even after 2020, got a bit of a knock. Where we suddenly realized we don't know the answers. Right? And we have now a year where no one knows what's going to happen. And no one knows what is happening. And you have the greatest medical experts, which I've heard many, many recordings of, really legitimate mainstream medical experts, who have to admit and say, we actually don't know what's going on. We think masks are good, but we're not sure. We think this is good, but we're actually not sure. Actually, no one knows. And they still don't know. It's a year in and they still don't know. Amazing thing. So what's the point? And you know what the point is? Because just to take one little aspect of what the Talmud said before, that this rabbi said that it's so tall that you go up and you look down, that the greatest palm trees look like grasshoppers, right? Part of the problem when we start to control everything, or we think we control everything, is that we stop seeing the hand of God. We stop seeing the miraculous part of our life, right? We don't realize that everything is so unbelievably miraculous because we take everything for granted. We don't realize how amazing it is that the sun rises in the east in the morning. We don't know how amazing it is that we take a breath, how complicated each breath is. I don't know where I mentioned this. It might have been one of the videos lately, but I remember a doctor telling me once that, I went to the doctor, I don't know why we were schmoozing about this, but he was talking about medicine. He said that when you learn medicine, there's a whole book, he says, this thick, just about the thumb. I said, what's so complicated about the thumb? He said, oh, you have no idea. Right? Its function, its purpose, the design, how amazing it is, how complicated it is, right? Just one book about the thumb, right? And here we have hundreds, millions of different animals, species. Everything is unbelievable, right? So there's a passage in our prayers that we say every day, right? When we wake up in the morning, there's... Oh, yes, I know where I said it, yeah. Sorry, I just said different things in different places. I was trying to... It was bothering me. In the meditate and pray thing we do Sunday morning, right? So we know that we have two types of halal. We have two types of times that we praise Hashem. So lately I've been sort of exploring the concept of Hallel, which is a very, it's a special praise that we give God, like on Rosh Chodesh, on Pesach, on Hanukkah, where we sing Hallel and Shul, beautiful songs and so on. But we don't say Hallel every day. Why? Because Hallel is a prayer which is reserved for miraculous events. Like the song, they sang the song when they passed the Red Sea, right? But then there's a Hallel we say every day. It's part of our prayers. We say the Amidah every day, and it's with something called Modim, where we say, Al Nisecha Shebechol Yom. We thank God for the miracles that happen every day. Right? What miracles? A person go through a day and it's pretty normal. Well, what did you do today? Nothing much. You know, nice, boring day. Everything happened. Everything worked out. It was all good. That's a fundamental mistake. Why is it a fundamental mistake? Because we get into that mindset when we think that everything just happens, and the events that happen during a day, we make them happen. We wake up in the morning and we control the day. And of course, we don't control anything, as we know. We control our responses, but we don't control anything, right? As we've spoken about many, many times. So therefore, this concept that there's a Tower of Babel, which is still there, that transgression, that third transgression, that they thought that they control and prevent the flood, that they're invincible and they now have got it all worked out, that they can control what's going to happen, make sure the world doesn't get damaged, that's still there. And it's still there, and the consequence is that we look at palm trees, huge miracles, huge events, and we think they're insignificant. We think they're grasshoppers. We think they're nothing. Right? And that's, if there's one lesson we take away from last year, that's the lesson we have to take away. It's an obvious lesson. It's a lesson that you've all thought about, but it's a lesson we have to keep talking about, because it's so easy to just slip back into what we always have. It's so easy just to, when this is all over, please God, very soon, it's just all easy to just go back to normal and think that we still control. And we shouldn't do that. We should take upon ourselves. We should really come out of this lesson. I think that's what the takeaway from today. We should really come away, and if we're going to think about and reflect about what we can learn and what we could do going further, we have to incorporate into our life something that will be a constant reminder that it's not all us. Something reminder that there's something else at play, that there's something. Now, of course, we're supposed to do everything we're supposed to do. We're supposed to explore medicine. God gave us an opportunity. It's in the Torah, and He tells us we have to do it. We have to make a living, we have to develop medicine, and we have to discover things, and we have to always do that, right? I remember a few years ago, I met someone, quite a well-known person, a guy who was a big doctor in the reproductive field and in IVF, and he helps a lot of people, is a great person. But I remember just, he told me an expression, and it really, made me so nervous. I said to him, what do you do? I met him for the first time, I didn't know who he was. I said, what do you do? He said, I make babies. I said, the last time I remember, God makes babies. And he kind of said it with like a touch of arrogance, and it really this is what we've come to, right? Because we have such amazing technology today that, yes, someone thinks he makes the baby. You don't make babies. You are a gracious recipient of God's gift to allow technology to be discovered in such a way. And you have a good brain, thank God, which is also a gift. And you have a good power to understand things and to develop things and to implement things, which is also a gift from God, that you have been given the opportunity to be a little partner, to be part of the process of God's amazing creation of another baby. That's a different story, right? But that's not just him, it's all of us. We think we do things. And of course, we come back to the old, what could be seen as a cliche, but it shouldn't be. That like the Talmud says, we don't control anything, but we do control how we respond. Right? And this is what we've been taught. And I think the lesson is that but it goes away very quickly. And this is what the Talmud is saying. This is the insight, the depth. That part of the tower is still there. What that means is that if we aren't careful, we will slip right back into that. Unless we do something about it. Unless we maybe introduce a prayer every day where we take upon ourselves to say one extra line of prayer every day that recognize God's greatness, that recognize God's gifts. Unless we incorporate another mitzvah, that we do something just to have a consciousness, to remind ourselves that there's a gift out there, that God is running the world. We're still going to go about our life. We're still going to do our best. We're still going to do the best we can to make of God's world the best product that we can, because that's what He wants us to do. But never to talk ourselves into it, that we actually can prevent things and we can run things, but we really need to connect to that higher power, and not to make sure that although the tower will remain, because that temptation will continue to remain, but at least we'll make sure that we don't become part of it, and that we have that healthy perspective, which I think is the foundation in a big way to some of the other lessons that we can learn, which we're going to explore at great length over the next number of weeks. Good to see you all back. Again, good to see you all on Zoom, and have a wonderful day.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Good lesson to begin the day.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.